This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we hear talks from editor and author Anthony Arnov and Michael Schwartz, professor of sociology at Stony Brook. Both discuss the Iraq War, the media, and the anti-war movement. We'll also listen to Carolyn Ho, the mother of Lieutenant Eran Ouattara. She spoke out against her son's upcoming court-martial for refusing to deploy to Iraq. Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
In downtown New York City, anti-war activists and students crammed into a small fifth-floor abandoned office to confront and discuss the recent escalation of troops and funding of the Iraq War. Mostly standing, they listened to author Anthony Arnov speak. He is the author of Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal, which is recently out in paperback. It looks at why continuing the occupation is a wildly unrealistic and reckless strategy that makes the world a more dangerous place. His talk was followed by Michael Schwartz, professor of sociology at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. In his talk, Schwartz says the United States is fomenting the sectarian violence in Iraq. Both authors emphasize the need for citizens and soldiers to organize against the Iraq War, a strategy to deplete the human resources needed to sustain war. The less people they have to send to war, the better. Let's have a listen.
Thanks a lot. And thanks to 16 Beaver for putting up with us for for tonight. It's a great thing to do. And it's a testament to, I think, the people's desire for change. The people have stood out in the cold, and that so many people are here for this discussion and for similar discussions like this that are happening around the country. At the opening of Karl Marx's book, The 18th Brumaire of Louis Napoleon, he talks about Hegel's observation that history repeats itself. And then he says, but Hegel forgot to add the first time is tragedy, the second time is farce. And I think, unfortunately, we find ourselves more and more in a situation where we have to revise even Marx's observation and say that what we see today happening is history repeating itself, but not as farce, but just as further tragedy, with a tremendous, tremendous human toll. The situation in Iraq today really defies description, but just some fragments of an account of what has been wrought by the U.S. invasion and occupation since March 2003. You can look on today's New York Times front page, a report on the United Nations study of civilian deaths in Iraq last year, and they find a death toll that exceeds 34,000 Iraqis, a figure that represents the first comprehensive annual account of civilian deaths and a vivid measure of the death toll in Iraq. It points out it was compiled using reports from morgues, hospitals, and municipal authorities across Iraq, and was nearly three times higher than an estimate for 2006 compiled from Iraqi ministry tallies. It also goes on to note that it's double the figure of 2005, and rightly notes that it probably is an undercount. Not all of the districts have reported the death toll for December, but also the number of reported deaths is certainly lower than the actual number of deaths in Iraq today. And the death toll is only continuing to escalate. Leachy mentioned the fact that Iraq today has the world's largest refugee crisis. When you think about all of the refugee crises that exist in the world today, it's horrific to contemplate. More than 2 million Iraqis displaced, 500,000 internally displaced, people who are too poor to flee the country altogether because of the very prohibitive costs of leaving Iraq. There's high taxes that are imposed on people trying to go into Jordan, go into Syria. And on top of that, the United States, despite having the largest U.S. embassy anywhere in the world in Baghdad, the capital of Iraq, has not a single person in that compound who is helping people apply for asylum or deal with their refugee status. And last year, the quota for Iraqis to come to the United States was 500 Iraqis. More than 2 million displaced by the U.S.'s actions, and the door is closed to them. The inflation rate in Iraq has skyrocketed, not only as a result of U.S. occupation, but as a result of measures encouraged by the International Monetary Fund, which have been adopted by the Coalition Provisional Authority, and then were recommended by the Coalition Provisional Authority, and then adopted by the current puppet Iraqi government. So that the price of ordinary goods has gotten out of reach for most Iraqis. Unemployment has skyrocketed 60-70% around the country. And people standing in line for days, literally for days, to get some cooking oil, some heating oil, or some gas for their vehicles or for their electrical generators. Electricity is at a level lower in Iraq today than before the U.S. invasion. That's a period, recall, when the U.S. had subjected Iraq through the United Nations to more than 12 years of comprehensive sanctions that had bled that country, and 12 years of periodic bombardment of the country in the Clinton administration and in the early Bush administration, and after the consequences of the Gulf War and the Iran-Iraq War, which destroyed Iraq's infrastructure. Ethnic cleansing is taking place openly in cities across Baghdad. Neighborhoods that were formerly mixed, Sunni, Shia, Assyrian, Kurdish, being violently cleansed. Baghdad in particular being cleansed of Sunni families. And The Lancet came out with a study, which people may have seen, in which they estimated that since the beginning of the U.S. occupation in March 2003, there have been now more than 650,000 excess deaths in Iraq as a result of the complete disruption of that society. Iraqis today are afraid to leave their home, afraid to send their children to school, afraid their women to go out not wearing religious covering, even though they have freely dressed as they would have liked in the past, literally are living day by day in absolute terror. And if you look over the last 45 months of this occupation, I think one pattern is incontrovertible, that each day this occupation continues, the worse it gets. And what George Bush has just proposed, sending 21,500 more troops, most of those to Baghdad, some to Anbar province, is only going to make the situation worse. The longer the occupation continues, the worse it gets, and also the more the U.S. forecloses the possibility of any kind of future for Iraq. The U.S. claims, by sending more troops, it's going to bring stability to Iraq. But I think we have to make the argument that the U.S. is the main source of instability in Iraq today, and that rather than stemming sectarianism, rather than sectarian civil conflict, as the U.S. claims, they're actually fueling it and encouraging it, something that Michael Schwartz's work has very ably documented and flushed out. And rather than bringing democracy to Iraq, as George Bush claims, and as we hear over and over again in the establishment press, the U.S. today is denying democracy, denying self-determination to the Iraqi people. In essence, the U.S. is pursuing a strategy now in Iraq that's a classic colonial strategy. If force does not work, use more force, no matter how much opposition it provokes, and no matter what the human toll. Now, we heard the speech from Bush last week, and he's been going on 60 Minutes and Jim Lehrer and all over the place. Go back. November 2005, Bush was on the media giving speeches. He had a plan for victory in Iraq. November 2005, Plan for Victory, that had, in effect, the same proposals we now hear being trotted out again. August 2006, the Bush administration announced Operation Together Forward 2. We're going to send 14,000 troops into Baghdad. We're going to stabilize Baghdad. We're going to quell sectarian conflict in Baghdad. Instead, as a result, this was just since last August up to a couple of months ago, a massive spike in attacks on U.S. troops and a massive spike in sectarian conflict in and around Baghdad as a result of the U.S. troops being sent into that situation. The new plan also involves a very real likelihood of a confrontation between the United States and the forces of Muqtada al-Sadr, which will only provoke greater resistance and rebellion against a foreign occupation that the overwhelming majority of Iraqis, whether they're Sunni or Shia, absolutely reject. Now, it's easy to talk about Bush and to talk about the Republicans right now, but I think we have to be very clear that this is the Democrats' war as much as it is as the Republicans' war, and they have to be held accountable every bit as much. In fact, in some ways, they have to be held more accountable for the mess that we now find ourselves in. And what are the Democrats saying? They're saying they might pass a non-binding resolution criticizing the addition of these troops to Iraq, or maybe criticizing the addition of another possible escalation of troops beyond this mobilization that Bush has proposed. They're talking about oversight of Bush. He needs to have oversight. When what they need to be talking about is something absolutely different, which would be a complete defunding of the war and a drive to bring all the troops home immediately. And it's clear, I think, that what we see now happening is a tactical debate, a tactical fight over how best to move forward in a situation where the United States finds itself having been so clearly overconfident and arrogant about what it could achieve in Iraq. And underlying that tactical debate is a bipartisan consensus, Democrat and Republican alike, about the need for the United States to be the hegemonic power in the Middle East and globally, and then a tactical fight over how best to achieve that given the circumstances in which the United States finds itself today. And I think the situation we're in is quite analogous to one that the U.S. Empire was in the late 1960s in Vietnam, where the United States had been clearly militarily defeated by the opposition of the Vietnamese people to their imperial designs in Vietnam. And the internal record now shows quite clearly that there was an awareness of this at the highest level of government. But the stakes for U.S. empire meant that there was an escalation in Vietnam, and not just an escalation in Vietnam, but an expansion of the war to Laos and Cambodia. Just as we heard the threat of an expansion of this war to Iran and to Syria in Bush's speech last week and in many other statements from this administration, from Condoleezza Rice and so on, and also as we saw the presaging of with the U.S. sponsorship of the brutal invasion of Lebanon this past summer, and as we've seen in recent actions in Somalia and also elsewhere in the region. We face a very real threat that such an escalation, an expansion of the war, is the logical outcome of the path that Bush is pushing us towards. And they do not care how many more U.S. soldiers will be killed and injured in that process. They do not care how many more Iraqis or Syrians or Iranians will be killed in that process. And the only thing that is going to alter them from their course is such a level of resistance in this country, within the military, and from the people at the other end of the U.S. gun that they are forced to retreat because they have to rethink the calculus of their imperial power, just as they were forced to do in Vietnam. If folks haven't read it yet, there's a very good article by A.K. Gupta, Arun Gupta, in the new issue of The Independent. I think I saw someone handing them out here. And pick up a copy. He's got some great articles, and he has one sidebar called Anti-War Dems Say Yes to Empire. And he has this to say. He says, anti-war leaders suppressed protests during an election cycle once again in the hopes that the Democrats would deliver us from Iraq. If the anti-war movement is committed to ending the war, it needs to act like it. The best route is by making the political lives of the Democrats hell. Only as a result of unrelenting pressure, protests, disruptions, occupations of their offices, and more will the Democrats move as a party toward ending this debacle. Absent that, the Iraq War will go on and will dominate another election 2 years from now, where candidates talk of how much they oppose it, even as they remain committed to supporting it. I think that's exactly the right way of looking at it. And we've just seen an election in this country, the midterm congressional elections, turn over a majority in the House, a majority in the Senate, a majority of governorships to the Democrats as a clear repudiation of U.S. policy in Iraq and a desire of a majority of people in this country to bring the troops home. And we see no clearer example of the hypocrisy of the idea that the United States is bringing democracy to Iraq. They're denying democracy in Iraq, and they're denying democracy in this country at home. They're also ignoring the will and the desire of a majority of soldiers, the troops who they're sending in now for the third, fourth, some cases fifth tour of duty into Iraq. Zoghbi International did a poll last year showing 72% of active duty troops on the ground in Iraq wanting to be out by the end of 2006. And now they're being told, stay there longer, go back. If you've come back and been reunited with your families, you thought the nightmare might have ended. And that's why it's so important that we are connecting with those soldiers who are speaking out, those soldiers who have declared conscientious objection, those soldiers who are organizing in groups like Iraq Veterans Against War, who are organizing in the military and among military families to build that resistance. If you go back to the Vietnam War, if you've not seen it, you have to see the film Sir, No Sir, the documentary, which is out on DVD now. It's a vital document about the GI Rebellion and the vital role it played in ending the Vietnam War. And there's a book here, Soldiers in Revolt, by David Courtwright, Howard Zinn, published by Haymarket Books. It updates that story, relates it to Vietnam, and it was the inspiration. That book was the inspiration for the documentary, Sir, No Sir. That is absolutely crucial. But also, I think we have to be clear that within the anti-war movement, in addition to supporting those voices of soldiers, supporting the GI resistance, we need to be building and coalescing around a very clear message of out now. Not in 6 months, not in 6 years, not in 12 years, but immediately. Bring the troops home now. They're destroying Iraq. They are serving absolutely no purpose. And they're denying, rather than building, democracy for the Iraqis. And within that movement, I think we also have to have a very sober and serious conversation about what kind of society we live in that goes over and over and over to war for oil, that kills and slaughters and destroys people for the power and profit of a handful of people in this country. And we need to build a genuine democracy. And that means dismantling the roots of the military-industrial complex, dismantling the roots of empire, which lie in the sick and completely twisted economic system we have that cares more about profit, cares more about power, cares more about the ownership and complete irrational destruction of the Earth's environment rather than human need, rather than any kind of meaningful future for ourselves or our children.
There are a couple of points that I'd just like to return to because I think they're maybe particularly interesting and other people haven't addressed them. One of them is what happens if the U.S. attacks Sadr, which, you know, people have been talking about that this is an escalation. Bush's new plan is an escalation. And I think that's really, really true. I don't think we should look at this as more of the same. I think we should look at this as a new stage in the war. And probably the biggest and most important element of that is if he follows through on his threat to attack the Sadrs. That means an invasion of Sadr City. It means an attempt to reconquer some of the southern cities. It probably means an offensive in Basra, which is the second largest city in the country. And it would mean a two-front war. It would be a good way to describe it. And the for all of the ferocity of the Sunni resistance, I don't think that 60% of the country probably be, you know, a real catastrophe for the Americans. Now, the specific question, in this new book that's come out, written by Gilbert Achcar and Noam Chomsky, the conclusion is an interview with Achcar in which he outlines all of the efforts that were made to create the unity between the Shia and the Sunni, very briefly, but it's a really succinct summary of it, and it's very good. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a real tragedy in this, and it's a tragedy that was engineered by the Americans, there's no doubt about it. Right after the first Fallujah battle, where Shia fighters went to Fallujah to fight for the with the Sunnis all over the Shia areas. People collected bread and food and everything and sent it up to Fallujah. The first fight, the U.S. said, okay, that's why they backed off. They felt the whole country was going to go up. If they tried to, you know, annihilate Fallujah, they said, we have to divide these away from each other, right? And I got a big help from the Sunni terrorists, you know, Zakari's group. Whether Zakari is the guy or not, it's come to be named after him, right? These jihadists who really see the Shia as their enemies, and they were able to help out by attacking Shia, right? That was when the division started. And Muqtada al-Sadr, who, you know, there's a lot of problems with this guy. This guy is not politically the guy you want to support, you know, right? But he is a nationalist, and he really tried to make a unity with the Sunnis, and he hasn't succeeded. And it's not clear what would happen, but I think the United States would be playing with fire if they attacked him, because it certainly would create the conditions under which that unity would be much easier to engineer. And so I think that we really have to keep our eyes on that moment. That moment that they really go into Sadr City is the moment that the war will change qualitatively in a very dramatic way, and all the equations will be different. And maybe you really will see a united resistance at that point. You know, just to add to this, the figures are this. There has never been a month where, according to official American figures, less than 65% of the armed confrontations have not involved the United States, have involved the lowest number where the United States was involved in the armed confrontations was 65%, right? Most of the rest are between the insurgents and the Iraqi army, right? All the stuff you read about is the remaining 10 to 15% at the most, usually less than 10%, right? Now, of course, these car bombs kill huge numbers of people, right? And these death squads are really horrible. I mean, we're not talking about good things here, right? We're talking about horrible slaughter here, right? But you've got to keep the proportions in mind, right? You know, and when you look at the death rates, right, Anthony mentioned Lancet study, right, which is the definitive study, and you know, this UN figure of 36,000, the actual figure is probably five times that many, right? If we use the Lancet numbers, which are the way to do it. By the way, the U.S. has sponsored surveys using this exact methodology in other countries, right? And then they denounce it, right, when it comes up against them, right? Okay, but 150,000 people dead in the last year, Iraqis, not an exaggeration, right? If it was 600,000 in the first years, just think about it. Has things gotten worse or better, right? Of those deaths, they can positively attribute a third of them to the U.S., a third to other sources, and the biggest part of that third is criminals, right? We never talk about criminals. Criminality is rampant wherever the U.S. goes, right? It's only when the U.S. gets out that these militias can tamp down on criminality, right? And there's an industry of kidnapping and murder, right? That's an industry. It's a private industry there. It's one of the biggest in the country. And then a third of the ones they can't identify. So of the third that they can't identify, probably most of them are the U.S. So U.S. direct hands of the U.S., the casualties are certainly over 50%. U.S. pulls out, those go away, mm-hmm. right? A lot of the other ones go away because most of these Sunni car bombers are attacking the Shia because they think the Shia are supporting the government, right? And they're saying, we have to intimidate these people to stop supporting the government. Virtually all of the death squads, which is a Shia activity, right, under the command of the U.S. most of the time, are people who are trying to get rid of the Sunni insurgency, right? Well, there is no Sunni insurgency if the U.S. gets out. So those go away, too. The odds are, now, look, there's a lot of bad stuff happening. There's a lot of friction between the two groups. It's building up all the time. Divide and conquer. It's the oldest strategy of any imperial power. The U.S. is using it every chance they get. I mean, they didn't even have to plan on it, right? They went into Iraq. They recruited a bunch of Iraqis to fight in Fallujah. They all quit. They all said, I'm not fighting. They said, I'm not going to fight other Iraqis. The army dissolved. So they said, well, who can we get here, right? So they started working with this ethnic division, right? And they started building it. And that's how they get fighters. But somebody said, well, what happens if they get themselves a big army and they use it to slaughter? These armies that the U.S. is recruiting, even the ones that are animated by ethnic hatred, they can never win against the militias. They never win. They send in the Iraqi army and it dissolves, right? They go away. They only stay when the U.S. units are with them, forcing them to fight. That's why they have to have the more U.S. units. If we can get the American troops out, we can still look forward to the fighting going way down. As much damage as we've done, as much hatred as we've fomented, I think we can still confidently say that the first thing that will happen is that the level of violence will drop drastically. There will be tons of problems, tons and tons of problems that are left behind, but it will be so much better without us there.
Pick up on something towards the end of where Michael left off, which is that in terms of this escalation, Bush also said in his speech that we've been hamstrung by rules of engagement that were overly restrictive in Iraq. So contemplate what that meant. Look at the Mahmoudiya massacre, the Haditha massacre, Abu Ghraib, all of the torture, all of the massacres, and then consider that they're now changing the rules of engagement for what they can do militarily, and that in addition to talking about the possibility of going into Sadr City, they're also talking about greater reliance on the Kurdish Peshmerga, bringing more of them down from the north, which adds a whole other element to the story. I think it's very important that we constantly step back from the lens that the media is looking at them through, because it is so easy, and I fall into the trap all the time, you know, when I'm talking about this, to come into a simple conversation of Sunni versus Shia, when there are so many internal political conflicts that are the overriding dynamic of what is happening in Iraq. And we have to always step back and remember the fundamental overriding dynamic is a conflict between an occupation and those who are under that occupation. And that overdetermines every one of the conflicts that may break out between Sunni and Shia, but also means that there's internal conflicts, Shia against Shia, Sunni against Sunni, and within that, conflicts with Kurds, conflicts with Assyrian Christians, and also a tension when you're talking about Iran, not just between strands of Shia, but between Arabs and Persians, other divisions that in the classic colonial divide and rule strategy that Michael referred to have always been used by colonial powers to gain their own advantage, which we always have to remind ourselves has nothing to do with democracy, nothing to do with stopping violence in Iraq, but has to do with the bases that the sister referred to, has to do with the oil that the United States wants to control, has to do with the project of establishing a client regime in Iraq from which the United States can project its power, not just regionally, but globally. And that brings us back to the main difference between Vietnam and Iraq, which is that so much more is at stake for U.S. imperialism in Iraq today than was at stake in Vietnam. And that means we have to be that much more clear and focused and organized in our opposition. I think something that Dow brought up is really, really important. And this strand is emerging of blaming the Iraqis, and that this is going to be more and more of the discourse that we're going to have to confront, including among people who are calling themselves opponents, critics of the war, which is this racist idea that we went in to help the Iraqi people, to bring democracy to the Iraqi people, but we just didn't realize how backward they were. We just didn't realize that democracy could not take root in the hostile soil of Iraq. This idea, you know, is so abysmally racist and backward. It not only accepts, as Dow pointed out, the idea that somehow the Iraqis welcomed us into their country, as opposed to the idea that we illegally invaded their country against their wishes, and that a clear majority of them want us to leave, as they're making abundantly clear day by day, but also it accepts the idea that the United States cares at all about building democracy in Iraq and in the Middle East or anywhere in the world, an idea for which there is absolutely no evidence whatsoever. And yet that idea frames the entire debate that is happening in the media today among pundits and politicians about what is happening in Iraq. There were a ton of fantastic questions, and I do think this is probably the most interesting conversation I've been in the last year or two about Iraq, and I think it reflects something very healthy about the anti-war movement right now and its potential that these kinds of discussions are happening and that this conversation is happening. But I think the question of Iran is one that I just quickly want to touch on that was raised early on, because I think that's another strand of the argument that's going to become more and more important as the Bush administration tries to blame resistance among Iraqis to U.S. occupation on outside interference in Iraq. An idea that really should get anyone who uses that expression laughed off the stage. And yet, George Bush, Condoleezza Rice, every day, we're against any foreign interference in Iraq, meddling in Iraqi internal affairs. And they want us to believe that Iran is somehow behind the fact that Iraqis are standing up against the United States, that they're responsible for the attacks. And again, go back to Vietnam. We have to attack Cambodia and Laos to cut off the supply routes to the NLF, to the resistance, to our designs. And that also, of course, raises the very dangerous prospect, the specter of a military confrontation with Iran, which completely changes everything. I think raises the very real possibility of nuclear conflict. The nuclear clock was just set forward. We're talking about the survival of the human species in a very concrete, immediate way. There was a, just to end on this, there was a, someone said, you know, we have to prove we can have an impact. I think that's absolutely right. I think there's a lot of skepticism, a lot of cynicism, a lot of feeling like we marched, we didn't have an impact. But you look at the point that Cindy made, that they only are able to send 21,500 troops to Iraq. We have had a material impact. They would like to have more troops. They would like to be able to send more, not only to Iraq, but they would have liked to have been able to be in a position possibly to have launched broader military strikes at this point. And their ability to do it rests on calculations about the number of troops, recruitment levels, the readiness of this army to fight its battles, and the level of opposition at home. And it's clear that we've begun to affect that calculus, and that it's not just us in this room, but it's the vast majority of people in this country who are turning against this war. It's the soldiers. It's the fact that recruitment is down for the military. They're having to come up with bigger lies to get people in, build bigger bonuses, lower the standards, do all kinds of things. But at the end of the day, if they could have sent 50,000 troops, it would be far worse than what they're now proposing, and there's limits being set on empire through our actions. We're beginning to have an impact. We can have much more of an impact the more people we get down on January 27th. But as a number of people said, it's a beginning. It's not one demonstration. It's a part of a process that we have to deepen and broaden and be in for the long haul. And I think with a vision of what we're fighting for, not just what we're against. Alexander Coburn had a brilliant line right after the midterm elections that I think it's worth reflecting on. He wrote a column called Now What? After November. He said, it's the role of elections in properly run Western democracies to remind people that things won't really change at all. You can set your watch by the speed with which the new crowd lowers expectations and announces what is not to be done. And we have to be the people who say what is to be done, what we're fighting for, what our vision is, and that's a vision worth fighting for.
He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA. And he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan, and he thinks we'll put an end to war this way. And he's fighting for democracy, he's fighting for the Reds, he says it's for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die, and he never sees the writing on the wall. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned him at Laval? Without him, Caesar would have stood alone. He's the one who gives his body as a weapon.
On January 16, a Fort Lewis military court ruled that Lieutenant Aaron Motada cannot present defense arguments related to the legality of the Iraq War. The effect of this ruling is that the court-martial proceedings scheduled for February 5th will be a mere formality, and Lieutenant Motada still faces up to 6 years in prison for his courageous stand against the Iraq War. Lieutenant Motada is quoted as saying, "As a commissioned officer of the U.S. Armed Forces, my legal and moral obligation is to the Constitution, not to those who would issue unlawful orders. It is my duty to refuse to fight this illegal war." We go now to a speech from Carolyn Ho, mother of Lieutenant Aaron Motada. She spoke out against her son's upcoming court-martial for refusing deployment to Iraq.
I hope we will you will join me in giving a very warm welcome to Carolyn Ho.
Well, good evening, everyone. It's a pleasure for me to be speaking in front of such a wonderful group. And thank you very much to the multiple sponsors. And there are a number too many for me to mention. So my deepest gratitude to all of you for your work, especially to the Justice for Yi group who had really worked with The World Can't Wait to spearhead this, and for all the other organizations. My indebted gratitude, my deepest gratitude to the women of the Global Women's Strike, Margaret Prescott, Phoebe Jones, Pat back there, Gloria, and Eric Jertson of Payday. Eric has been one of the most loyal mainstays of this whole operation. And also to Gloria Passes for making the offer to come up to support me. It is true that we need to support the statement of conscience that our children are making. And we live in troubled times right now that call for extreme measures. And so given that, we as mothers need to come forward, come out of the kitchen, and to also make that statement that is necessary to make changes in society. I'd like to share with you my journey because it runs alongside what occurred with my son in some respects. My son decided to sign up for the military unbeknownst to me in 2003. I realized that he was moved by what had occurred during 9/11 and was quite disturbed by what had been going on. But I didn't realize that after graduation in June of 2006, he would be joining the military. He came to me and made that announcement and said that, you know, he was going to go. And I immediately got into a huge fight with him over that. And we went on, and then finally my son said to me, "And now do you realize why I didn't tell you before I signed on?" And then, of course, I realized it was a done deal and there was no point in going on. And I needed time to begin to accept that and to tell him that I loved him and that I was behind him all the way. And, you know, wherever he was in the world, my heart would be with him. So off he went to basic training and then to officer training school, then decided to do his first deployment to Korea for a year. As a young officer, he of course had to go through the hard work of training, and actually ended up with wonderful evaluations, which I never knew about until the John Kiffner article came out. And I guess that was back in July of 2006, where Mr. Kiffner alluded to this young lieutenant and his glowing evaluation. And the evaluation said, in as few words as possible as I can express, that this was a young lieutenant who had shown remarkable leadership. And it said, and I quote, "Promote before the rest." Pretty modest. He doesn't go on tell me all these things. So after the closing of his tenure in Korea, he was given the choice of either staying in Korea or returning to the United States to train for the war in Iraq. And he decided to train to go to Iraq. So he was shipped to Fort Lewis. In June of 2005, he began the work of an officer, which is basically to start the research on the war that you're about to enter, to try to understand the history of the country you're going to, the impact of the war on the civilian population, and also the impact of the war on your soldiers. And as he did the research, he was stunned by the fact that there were no WMDs, and that much of the evidence that the American public and the Congress was given, which became the basis for why we went to war, was based on deception. And he said he was stunned when he read things like the Downing Street memo and other kinds of documents, that a lot of the policy or the facts that were derived from CIA documents and other sources were actually shaped around a policy that had been made before 9/11. That was pretty shocking to him, because as an officer, he was sworn to obey the orders of his commander-in-chief. And he began to have serious doubts about whether or not he could follow through. And he mentioned some of those doubts off and on, but I never really took it very far. And then in January 1 of 2006, my son calls home and makes the announcement, and he says, "Mom, I want you to know that when the deployment orders come, I am not going to deploy." I was stunned, unprepared for that, just not knowing what to say. And finally I said, "Have you thought about this really carefully? Why do you need to do this? What point are you trying to make? You're just one little lieutenant in this big, big military industrial complex. What possibly can you do by this action?" And I said to him, "You're going to ruin your career. You're going to ruin your reputation. You will be vilified in the press, in the public, by people in the community, and you have everything to lose." And I was just so saddened by this whole thing. Very, very depressed by it. It took me quite a few days to come to terms with this. And then I realized, and I don't know if some of you are aware of the Gibran poem about, it's the book, The Prophet, and the prophet speaks about our children. And he says, "Your children are not your children, but they belong, they come through you, but they don't belong to you, but they are life's expression of what is meant to be." And so he decided, June 7, 2006, the day before his 28th birthday, he went public and announced his decision not to deploy when the unit left for Iraq. On June 22nd at 2:30 a.m., the unit did deploy. His name was called, and of course he did not answer. He remained in the office, and he had assured his commander that he would do that out of respect for the men and their families. He had assured them that he was not going to get a contingent of demonstrators out there waving flags and creating a big commotion, that he would refrain. After most of the men had deployed, my son was taken into a small room with several officers, and they worked on him for a number of hours to try to convince him that as a model officer, he could do the best for his men by actually going over to Iraq. And they told him, you have till 10:30 a.m. to get on the next plane. And if you do, we will forgive everything that has happened. Nothing, no punishment will be happening to you. And of course, my son, they didn't know my son. He's a very soft-spoken guy. But when he sets his mind to something, if he's convinced that he will do something, you cannot convince him. I, as his mother, know that, let me tell you. And so these people thought this Asian American, you know, being very, very understated, would probably be very easily talked into going. And so they were pretty surprised that he stood his ground. Then in July 5th, which is about a week after they allowed him to leave Fort Lewis. He had been detained for about a week, was not allowed to call out, but he was not imprisoned. He was just held in officers' quarters. He was released, and then on July 5th, formally charged. And the first charge was the failure to obey a movement order. The second charge was contemptuous remarks against President Bush. And the third charge was behavior and becoming an officer and a gentleman. So together, at that time, it was a maximum of 8 years in a military prison. Then fast forward to August 17th, the date of his pretrial, and in the military they call it an Article 32. That is the time when the investigating officer determines whether or not there are grounds for a court-martial. My son was allowed witnesses, and I think most of you know about Colonel Ann Wright, this lady who was really with it. She had been a lifetime colonel, very respected in the military, had served in a distinguished capacity in Afghanistan after we established a diplomatic corps there. But upon hearing that the president was going to go to war, she resigned in protest. So she came to speak about my son's case. And the military spoke specifically to whether or not the colonel thought that my son's action would contribute to disorder and a lack of discipline in the military. And she responded, and I wasn't there physically, but I was told that she responded, oh, that's a lot of nonsense. People have been making protest all along, and the military still continues fine. And so what the lieutenant is doing is not going to contribute to the demise of the military. We also had Dennis Halliday, who was formerly the deputy assistant to Kofi Annan, who spoke to what had gone on in Iraq prior to the beginning of the war. At that time, he was not working for Kofi Annan, but he certainly brought his expert testimony. And lastly, we had Dr. Francis Boyle, who was an international law expert with the University of Illinois in Champaign. And he has represented a number of resistors. And as far back as Dr. Yolanda Hewitt Vaughn, who was a military doctor who refused to give anthrax shots, which we know has proven deadly for a lot of our soldiers. But she was court-martialed and given 3 years. So we had these three illustrious people come to testify, but in spite of that, and in spite of the investigating officer saying that the lieutenant was very sincere, he said, there are grounds for a court-martial, and therefore he recommended it to Commander Dubik, the commander of Fort Lewis. Subsequent to that, my son was invited to the Vets for Peace Convention, held in the middle of August. And I'm going to show you the speech that he gave because I feel that it represents his position and the justification for his position and what he is calling for you, the American people, to do. But before that, I just want to give you a very quick summary of what is happening right now with his case. just recently, after the elections, the military chose to say formally that they will go ahead with what the investigating officer recommended. There will be a court-martial. A pretrial hearing is scheduled for January 4-5, 2007. And I understand World Can't Wait will be doing this big rally on January 4, so please don't forget him. And February 5th is the date of the court-martial itself. So all that said, I need to tell you that the military decided to drop the second charge, the contempt charge against the president. And so now we're down from 8 years to 6 years. And I don't believe my son has committed any crime and that he should be serving any years. But the military... Thank you.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show.
We'd like to thank our affiliates and our many listeners.
In the studio today, down here at WBAI in New York City, we've got Professor Louie and Fast Eddie, the poets of the street. Both of them were born, bred, and buttered in Brooklyn, the center of the universe. Louie's been rapping endless blues poetry and speaking, I suppose, since he was a couple years old. His mother, Rose, used to say, "You can't keep that boy quiet." He's here today with Fast Eddie on the bongos, playing backup for the wonderful rhythms. Louie's the poet. Without further chatter by me, they're going to play a song on Katrina. I first heard Fast Eddie back on December 9th at the Lynn Stewart Holiday Victory Party. And that's when they performed the song. I was sitting next to Lynn Stewart, and I said, "Boy, they're good. Give me their phone number. Maybe they'll come up to the studio and do us the honor of playing it live for our audience."
We should also tell the people listening that if something's happened in their community, their school, wherever, in their neighborhood, you know, rent strike, whatever, you know, they should give us a call at that same number.
That's 718-768-8728. Once more, 718-768-8728. Professor Louie, Fast Eddie, take it away.
Be all you can be. Do not be deceived, blind, and never see, running down through the street. Sun rises every day, same old every way. What will come today? Live in your life away. Playing a little ball, hanging out in the hall, watching all the girls, checking out the world. The kid next door screams at night, two guys downstairs having a fight. Cop calls making that sound, the neighbor smacking his wife around. While on your TV, every day you see people living in luxury, cool as they can be. High-priced cars, Mercedes bars, buy and sell you, ha ha ha, spending cash in a flash, got a stash of the finest hash while you go insane, riding on the train, ladies sleeping in the rain, shopping bags full of pain, bums out in the street, looking for a treat, and a garbage can full of meat. Isn't life so sweet? So be all you can be, do not be deceived, blind, and never see, running down through the street, getting up, going to school, playing by the rules. Everybody thinks you're a fool, you might as well be cool, and blow a little crack, shoot a little smack, get a little whack, never, never coming back. Crack the box and crack the locks and nobody knocks, the snow white rocks. Crack in the alley, crack in the street, cracking your brains all over your feet. And having no job, trying to rob, running with the mob, like a piece of shish kebab. On the corner, called nowhere, where nothing, nothing is fair. Waiting for nobody and nobody cares. Drinking and drinking that wine, wasting that time, wondering when will I get mine. So be all you can be. You joined the army you sail across the sea to a far country, fighting for Uncle Sam, doing what you can, M16 in your hand, in a foreign land, Grenada, Nicaragua, Lebanon, Cuba, Korea, Vietnam, Afghanistan, now Iraq. When were you coming back? But you were seeing the world, making it with all the girls, open up all the doors, looking for all the whores, yeah, smoking the finest grass, hoping your luck will last until it came to pass. Got a bullet in your ass, laid down in your grave, nothing left to save, died so very young, spring had hardly sprung, coming home to your block, in a wooden box, the neighbors were not shocked, the baby's cradle rocked, and it didn't matter at all, winter, spring, summer, or fall, the army was not small, they got someone else to call, and down on Wall Street, business was real neat, profit was real sweet, off of your dead meat. IBM, AT&T, the Rockefeller family, the corporations laughed at your epitaph, and your mama cried, your girl, your girlfriend sighed, your friends came by, higher, higher than high, and the preacher prayed for a better day, he had no better way, he had nothing to say, so your life went by, higher than high, there was nowhere to run, and nowhere to hide, be all you can be, you joined the army, you thought you were the hunter, you were the huntee, and the little kids on your block, they used to love you a lot, grandma and grandpa, they never saw you no more, what was it all for, I'm dying so poor, nobody makes it alone, we needed you at home, yeah, be all you can be, do not be deceived, running down through the street and reaching to be free, running down through the street and moving to be free, running down through the street pushing to be free, battling to be free, warring to be free, screaming to be free, struggling to be free, struggling to be free, struggling to be free.
Professor Louis, Fast Eddie, poets of the street, born, bred, and buttered in Brooklyn, came across the bridge to our studios here in Lower Manhattan at WBAI. Professor Louis, your number, I'm going to give it again, 718-768-8728. I'm going to repeat it. Free Brooklyn Now is the name of the record company, 718-768-8728. Fast Eddie, Professor Louis, thanks a million for coming on down. Appreciate it.
It's our pleasure.